Mike, your full-time job is ruining your own life.
It's the only job I'm good at.
Aww.
Are there full-time jobs that don't ruin your life?
Oh boy, I hope so.
I thought that's just how capitalism is supposed to function.
Is it just slower? Some things are slower?
Yeah, well, they keep you alive longer because it takes more effort to train someone new.
It's kind of like cancer. Everything's going to give you cancer, but some things will give you cancer much faster.
On that note...
This is figuratively and literally dark.
One of my big sources of comedy for myself on a daily basis is Quora.
Yes.
Oh.
And I saw this wonderful Quora thread. My favorite ones are the ones that are just like, what is rich white guy's daily routine like?
Mm-hmm.
And this one was about Peter Thiel, who I mostly know through like my immigration work because he's a huge asshole.
Indeed.
And he's like, what is Peter Thiel's daily schedule like? And someone immediately answered just because they've pieced together from reading interviews with him over years what his daily routine is like. And one of the things that he does, apparently, is take HGH, human growth hormone. And someone responds and says, like, he can't take HGH. That gives you cancer. And the original poster says, that's true, but Peter is very confident that cancer will be cured in the next 10 years.
I have a lot of questions.
I feel like when people talk about like having like confidence that I have, I don't even know what confidence looks like anymore, clearly.
Okay. This is the show. This is definitely the show that's going in.
Yep.
Today on Let's Make Mistakes, we have three hosts, which is back to what is normal. It's going to be great.
There's nothing normal about it.
That is Mike. Steph is over here. Say hi, Steph.
Hi.
And I'm Liam Campbell. And today in the studio, we have a special guest, Channing Kennedy, who is introduced to us by our lovely engineer, Seven. Channing is fascinating, we have found.
We don't know what Channing does, but Seven really wanted him.
Well, that's the thing. We looked you up and we still can't tell, but we are intrigued. Here's my favorite introductory fact is that there was a period of time in which if you Google image searched white guy on Google, the Google, you would come up with a picture of Channing first.
Yes.
You were representing white guys everywhere.
So the irony about that is that the reason that happened is that I wrote a piece for NPR about stereotypes and whether or not stereotypes negatively impact like white people and white men the same way that they do like historically disenfranchised groups. And I argued that no, they do not, that the purpose of stereotypes is to reinforce that disenfranchisement. And therefore, like white people like, can exist mostly without like outside of stereotypes, that no one white person sums up all white people because there is no one who is trying to oppress or who is succeeding in oppressing white people using that mechanism. After I wrote the piece about how no one white person can stand in for all white people, I later became the number one Google image result for a white guy via irony.
That's spectacular.
Yeah.
Where can people find that piece?
It is on NPR. I want to say it's on the Code Switch blog.
It is. I just checked it.
Okay. So it's still there.
It is still there. I've seen it. You can do it.
So are you still the number one white dude on Google?
No, I fell off a while ago. But the reason that I found out that I even was that is because my friend Amina Amanatuso messaged me and said, why is this French soccer enthusiast using your picture for his Twitter profile picture while he makes fun of white people? And I reverse engineered the thought process. Like, if I wanted to make fun of white people, how would I find a picture?
Oh, wow.
He would search white guy. And I did. And it was me.
That's
and
awesome.
I immediately put it on my LinkedIn as under awards.
That's great.
I'm a little jealous.
Yeah. I didn't think to check your LinkedIn because I've never thought to check anyone's LinkedIn for anything.
What do you get when you're the number one white guy on Google image search?
Well, you get to put it on your LinkedIn under awards. That's pretty much it.
You didn't feel that there was any pressure resting on your shoulders?
I made a big fuss about it on social media because I figured no one else was going to get any mileage out of it if I didn't.
Sure. Yeah.
So like a mountain of strange that comes with it?
Not really. I mean, if you like reverse image search that picture of me now, you'll find a bunch of like trolls on message boards and stuff like that who are just using like a generic white guy photo, which happens to be me.
You do look like a white guy. Like,
I know.
I would endorse you.
You are kind of a generic white guy.
Yeah, people often have trouble describing me.
Nondescript.
The cool Sorry. Shirt.
He looks like he'd be, you know, waiting in line at a bank.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do that.
Yeah, they but he looks like that. He would be doing sure. that.
They have candy if you get up to the front.
Your bank has candy?
Yeah, Chase, they give you little dum-dum pops. And I asked them to dig around to find the sarsaparilla ones.
So, since your time as America's Next Top White Guy, what have you been up to? What do you do? Because you alluded to the fact that it's difficult to nail down. Like, how do you describe yourself?
I do a bunch of different stuff. I do, for many years I worked at Color Lines magazine and its parent organization, which is now called Race Forward, which was called the Applied Research Center while I was working there. I now do some video production. Right now I'm working with a group of state level and city level bureaucrats who are getting trained up on how to pass racial equity legislation in their cities using the same techniques that were used to pass really racist legislation over the past several decades, which is really fascinating work. And I love working with all those folks. I also do like some racial equity trainings. I've done some trainings for like Color of Change, ACLU, California, like Cal Shakes. Normally it's me and my friend Tammy Johnson, who is the person most responsible for me not being a complete asshole today, because she took me under her wing when I first started working at Color Lines and was like, said to me several times in several different situations, here's why what you just said is fucked up.
Oh.
She's that friend, which is absolutely invaluable.
Minority splaining.
I don't even think it's that. I think it's just like, I think that anyone could have objectively said that the things that I was saying was fucked up. But she put herself out there to cut it off.
You should hang out in our office for a day. This is the most racist office I've ever worked at.
This is the least racist place I've ever worked.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, how many offices have you worked in?
A bunch. Some of them were in Texas.
Oh, shit. Okay, then
Jesus.
Yeah.
Wow.
We're just open about it.
Jesus Christ, Mike. What? Who is whispering in your ear all day?
Sarah.
Oh, okay. Mm. She's French.
See?
Well, it's a totally different history
racist
of immigration there.
Right there. By the way, I'm so glad that we brought in a white guy to talk about race.
I know, finally.
It's so Silicon Valley. This is the most Silicon Valley thing we've ever done. So can you tell us about race?
I mean, how much money do you have?
Well, I'm white.
So in addition to doing racial equity trainings, I also do, I'm the executive director of San Francisco Zine Fest, which I had to ask my wife to stop giggling when I mentioned that to people, because she knows that it's an unpaid position that nobody else in our team wanted.
Oh. No, trust me, that came through loud and clear when you said Zine Fest.
Yeah. And I do story time at a daycare in East Oakland, which is probably the thing that I actually enjoy out of all the things that I do.
Also unpaid. Yeah.
But I get a bunch of hugs and high fives every time.
Hugs are real.
From small children who would probably never wash their hands ever.
Mm-mm. That's the real currency right there.
Yeah.
Yep.
So this race stuff, what did you call it?
Yeah, the phrase we use is racial equity instead of racial, like, equality.
All right, so racial equity training.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so what do you do? You do workshops about that, you said?
Yes.
All right, so talk me into going into this workshop. Do you go into people's offices or do people come to you?
It goes either way.
All right. Talk me into hiring you to do a racial equity workshop at my company. What do I get out of that? Why would I do it? Why should I hire a white dude?
If you are in, well, first of all, I suggest that you hire me and Tammy
because
we're a great team. Tammy Johnson, who formerly with Race Forward is the founder of the Legislative Report Card Project, which went state by state, rating every state and every piece of legislation on how it impacted communities of color. She oversaw that entire project for years. She's brilliant. She's now the executive director of a group called Girls Rocks, which teaches girls in Oakland belly dance and body image politics.
It's a good combination.
Yeah.
She's super, super fantastic and is an incredible performer in her own right. And she and I work really well together, or at least I think so. We will come into your organization. We'll do a half day or a day long training. I did a training for Color of Change recently where I talked about, one of the segments that we did was talking about the idea of implicit bias, the idea that we all have these prejudices that exist in the back of our head that maybe we realize that are there, maybe we don't, maybe they manifest in ways we see, maybe we don't. Showed people like the whole like instructional video, had a conversation about it. And then because these are all folks who are going and doing like media campaigns, I showed them a video, which I think is a fascinating example of this phenomenon, which is one that Move On put out in 2008. That's an anti-John McCain ad. It's making the explicit argument that John McCain is responsible for George W. Bush's, you know, wartime policies, essentially, that he's the one who like drafted the invasion plan, which is pretty much true. But the way that they illustrate that John McCain and George Bush are very close is by showing a series of photos of the two of them hugging and being physically affectionate towards each other.
Mm-hmm. Like bra and panty tickle fight shit.
Like arms wrapped around each other. Photos that when you look at them, your first instinct is to laugh. And then if you look at it for another 5 seconds and you ask yourself, why am I laughing at the idea that two men are hugging each other? You realize that you have like a bunch of like embedded shit in the back of your head. Move On, when they launched this ad, decided that they didn't care, or maybe they didn't notice in the first place. So they just went like loud with this ad. It's 30 seconds. It's short. It's to the point, and it stays with you because it's funny, but it's also homophobic as shit.
Yeah.
And it's one of those ads where they decided, or they didn't decide, that there are some people's opinions and lifestyles that they just don't care about. Hmm. And this is like, these are the good guys. These are the people who are fighting to get Barack Obama elected in 2008. And they made a decision. So what I'm training these folks to do when they're like working on campaigns is think about everyone who you want to watch this ad.
Yeah.
Could it be that it was funny because they're both homophobic as hell?
There
might be a shade of that, but they definitely didn't make that case in the 30-second ad that was entirely about wartime policies.
I mean, I can't imagine those two hugging and it not being awkwardly funny.
You could argue that was awkwardly funny, but I think you also just have to look at the outcomes.
Go on.
And the outcome in this case is that the punchline of the video is the last photo that they showed, which is the two of them hugging, like putting their heads together, sort of forming like a heart shape.
Oh, well, I haven't seen the video, so I'm not going to argue the other side too hard. So what else? What else would I do? What happened at this workshop? Like, how would I change after having gone through your workshop?
You might not change at all. The goal is for the outcomes of the things that you do to change.
How do the outcomes of the things that I do change without me changing?
We would help you set up like a impact analysis, basically, on the actions that you're doing.
Okay.
To see who you're hiring, what their backgrounds are, what your hiring process is, who your clients are, where your folks are coming in from, and like what kind of perspectives that you have in the room in any given meeting.
Okay.
And it would help you tie those to like distinct economic factors. Like, what is your retention rate for employees of color, for example? You can have a very diverse workforce, but it might be a diverse...
Oh, we don't hire those.
But it might be a diverse workforce in which, like, you're losing one-tenth of your workforce, like, every 6 months because they can't stand to work in your office.
Oh, I've worked at that kind of place.
Right.
So do a lot of companies approach you because they're recognizing that there is a problem? Or is it more like complaints? Or how do you get in touch with these companies?
I would say it's 50-50 that some companies are approaching us because they really want to make a difference, and some companies are approaching us because they want to get critics off their back.
Hmm.
Interesting.
And sometimes we don't work with people who aren't ready to like really engage with like a serious like long-term like commitment to like actually revising their shit. And sometimes it doesn't matter why they come to us if we can get them to like reconsider what they're doing.
So if Mark Andreessen called you up, you wouldn't take him on?
Oh, no, I would definitely work. I mean, like...
He's not ready. He's so not ready.
He's not ready, but I could pay my rent for nearly a year, for nearly 2 months with as much money as I would get from that.
I think you're right that there is not a not room in his pointy head yet.
Well, no, I mean, Mike said that.
Yeah, well, okay.
Yeah, I said that.
You said
said pointy head.
I did say pointy head.
Mark, if you're listening, I have faith in you.
You body shamed him.
Head shamed him.
Cranium shamed him.
Cranium shamed.
But I mean, that would be a really high impact person, though. If you could change someone's perspective at who has that reach.
We've actually talked about that because like a lot of the work that Tammy used to do was around state legislators and like seeing them as like focal points for like where change happens. And in a lot of places now, especially the Bay Area, the people who really determine policy are huge tech companies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you could get the tech companies even to see that they can make more money if they are less racist, like that would be a positive for a bunch of folks.
That would be spectacular.
But that said, like Google has an entire in-house training department just around implicit bias and nobody gives a shit. Like everyone goes to the training because it's mandatory.
Right.
And then they get checked off their list and then they like go back to work forcing people to use their real legal names in like all of their online transactions.
Because they have a higher incentive to make money doing the thing that they're doing rather than change their practice. There isn't enough incentive for them to change what they're doing. Or why do you think that they maintain that their policies, even if there is like an internal team that's trying to stop that?
My guess is that the internal team that trains people does not actually have the power to change policy.
Mm.
And sometimes at the end of the day, you can't like wait for people to catch up with like your good intentions. You just have to like start changing policies and hope that people like come around to it.
I wonder if there's also kind of an, you know, I got mine attitude too. People just sign off on this thing, but they don't really take it to heart because they haven't been in that position either. Like they're just, you know, like I'm working, I'm making money.
Yeah, okay. I mean, of course, like no one thinks that they are ever like not the underdog in any given situation, no matter how like consciously you might think you've been, that you have like gotten like special treatment in life. You always assume that you struggled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because America is predicated on the idea that all of us like have very individual specific trauma that we overcame and that is equal to everyone else's trauma.
So if I hear you correctly, you don't think our biggest problem is just straight up like, I hate everything, I'm a racist. It's people who don't understand the inherent biases that they walk into a situation with.
I absolutely think that's true.
Because I think in Silicon Valley, our biggest problem is that we're hiring people who all have, you know, within a margin of a small margin of error, the same upbringing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They come from the same place. They went to, you know, basically they went to school. They all went to the same types of schools.
Right.
You know,
they met each other at school.
Mm. There ain't much difference between Penn and Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And they all come to, and they all solve problems from that same point of view.
Right. That the biggest crisis that has happened to any of them in their lives is that their mom stopped doing their laundry for them. So that's the problem they're going to solve.
But that's okay because the place where they work does their laundry. So that's not really an issue. That hasn't come up.
But when they think about what are some problems to solve, they never think of like, for example, that the drinking water in their hometown has a bunch of lead in it. Because they didn't come from that hometown. They think, I'm stoned at 3 a.m. and I'm super hungry. And when they're solving that problem, they don't think about, boy, I wish it would be great if people could get paid living wages because they never had to worry about that problem.
Why don't the people in Flint just have Uber bring them water?
I know, man. It's like not even trying.
Just Instacart it. It's not that big of a deal.
There actually are a bunch of bottled water companies that are just like setting up camp in Uber. Not in Uber, in Flint right now.
Uber, Michigan. That is...
If Flint would just change their name to Uber.
Flint, sponsored by Uber.
Right. They would probably start getting written about in tech news.
Jesus Christ. We're painting a really dystopian vision right now.
It's not dystopian if it's already happening.
Yeah. Yes, we're just talking about what's going on today.
Current events.
You're just in your fucking bubble, Liam.
I am.
Wake up. Read Common Dreams.
What is that?
Wait.
I shouldn't like trash talk other publications.
Okay.
Twitter just hired a head of diversity, though, so things are getting better.
Is that the white dude? Is that the dude who used to be the head of diversity at Apple?
That's the one.
Yeah.
It's the white guy.
That's the one.
So that's going well. Everything's going fine.
Has he started?
I don't know.
The thing is that you could have like a white guy in charge of your program of like about diversity. It would look shitty. Well, but if he's doing good work, then
we have
like
a white guy talking about race here.
Right.
So,
and this podcast is just garbage so far. So this isn't a great example. But
oh boy. Yeah, it's entirely possible that, you know, good work might come out of that. I hope so. But from the outside, it doesn't look promising exactly. It doesn't look like the beginning of the solving of a problem.
No, I mean, because Twitter is still Twitter at the end of the day.
Right.
There's still a company that went public that has to answer to like their stockholders.
Yeah.
So what's wrong with white people, man? They seem like assholes.
Oh, I have a list. one thing that I'll actually disclose is that often when we are doing racial equity trainings in rooms of mostly white people, that I don't talk about implicit bias. And the reason is that white people will happily seize that as an opportunity to talk about how racist they are, as long as they are still allowed to talk about themselves as the primary topic of conversation.
Interesting.
Give us a story. Change the names.
We did a training a while ago, and we started talking about implicit bias. It was mostly white. Actually, it doesn't even have to like be mostly white people. There's like one white guy in the room. He'll definitely like take up 20 minutes talking about how racist he is, because I've been that white guy plenty of times, to be clear. Like, that's the way to make me hate you is to remind me of myself at all.
I think that's true of
that. That explains my father.
We've also done trainings where we talked about implicit bias in rooms full of white people, and then someone will get up and they say, like, I understand this concept because people have bias against me because I am short. Mm. When that person said that, I started to feel like maybe I'm actually terrible at my job. But, you know, everyone has a process. Everyone, like, gets to where they're going at the speed that they're going to go at.
Yeah.
Did that printer just turn on?
No, it's the thing over there.
Oh, okay. I thought we moved that.
We moved it over there.
Yeah, it's moved.
It's still in the room.
I think there's a foam pad on it now.
Yeah, just put a carpet over it. It'll be fine.
Throw a blanket over it.
All right. How long does it stay on?
I don't know.
Really? All right. Are we back?
I don't think we ever left.
Okay.
Here we are.
Hmm. Mm. So,
You go, Mike. You go.
I've asked like 10 questions in a row.
All right, I want to go. I would like to know more about ZineFest, because zines are amazing and strange. And until recently, I considered them to be a past tense sort of noun. I did not see zine or zine culture aside from having like read Boing Boing for years and years and years. But then recently we started working over here in North Beach, and I started going to City Lights and the weird disused shelves and discovering all kinds of weird zines that I love. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, we have a designer here who's starting a zine. He's starting a zine in 2016.
Is that like starting a podcast?
It's kind of, yeah.
Where you just like talk about it a lot?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
He makes noises about printing it, but you know, we'll see. So tell us about ZineFest.
Maybe you should talk to him afterwards. He's having trouble finding a good printer.
Oh, yeah.
I would actually be really interested.
What do you need a printer to make a zine
The best printer is like your own office after hours.
Yeah.
So he has this great concept for the cover that he's explained to me, and he just can't find anyone to print it in San Francisco.
Does he want to like Rezo print it or what? I can just talk to him.
Yeah, just talk to him. I'm going to botch it.
Okay.
This is why everybody I knew in college had jobs at Kinko's.
Yeah. Mm.
So you could print your zines and band flyers.
This is why I still have the keys for the Race Forward office in Oakland. also because they let us use the conference room there for free for ZineFest meetings.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is, we really actually come to think of it, need to get them like some free ad space in the program. Because they've definitely made this fest happen more than just about any other organization.
Oh, when is the fest?
The fest is Labor Day weekend.
Okay.
In Golden Gate Park. At the County Fair Building, we tried very hard to find a new venue because the big issue, a couple issues with the County Fair Building, it's a fantastic space because it's so big and it's so like aesthetically nice.
Yeah.
But it's also way the fuck hell away from BART,
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which means, and because our primary clientele, both for exhibitors and attendees, are people who can no longer afford to live in San Francisco.
Yeah.
That poses a problem. Also, we ran into some issues last year where we wanted to have some of the bathrooms be relabeled as gender neutral. Mm-hmm. And due to, like, everyone that we talked to was completely on board with that, but due to city regulations, we couldn't do it.
Oh.
So we might try to get, like, some porta potties or something this year, but.
Oh, I can hear the complaints about that already.
There is not a scenario in which there won't be complaints. So I'd rather have the people that I know whose opinions I care about, like, be satisfied.
That's a beautiful mantra.
I'll let you know if it ever works.
Awesome. So that's a physical, big old event, like an like 2 day thing or 1 day or?
We were 2 days. We just cut down to 1 day because rent is going up there like it is everywhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When we went from 2 days to 1 day last year for the first time, we found that we actually had a little bit of a surplus. So, mm-hmm. So this is how like my work in race equity and my work at Zine Fest have kind of overlapped, is that basically we did a racial equity impact analysis of Zine Fest to figure out where we should be allocating our resources. We found that by doing a one-day fest, we had enough money to do things like hire an ASL interpreter for our main panel event, which we had never done before, or pay stipends to our panelists who are traveling from out of town. You know, a few other things like that. They're just like real basic things. As everyone in this room knows, and Mike, something you've been a great proponent of, is that the way to get like diversity in a room of workers is to like actually pay the workers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we did not any longer want to be part of a system where people like couldn't afford to show up to like talk about their work. Like that's just shitty that we're not part of the solution in that case. Actually, a couple of years ago, I ran a panel on race and gender in zines and invisible barriers to participation. And of my three panelists, all three of them came from Oakland. All three of them spent 2 hours each way on public transit to get to that 1 hour panel. And none of them received a stipend from us because we didn't have anything budgeted. So we were not part of the solution that year with that panel.
Why are you doing it in San Francisco?
Because it's the San Francisco Zine Fest.
Hmm. Well, you could rename it the Oakland Zine Fest.
Well, we could. There are a couple of Zine Fests in Oakland already, though, that are really excellent. There's EBABS, there's Monster Mash, there's a few other ones. And also, we're the last Zine Fest in San Francisco.
Oh. And was the other Ape? Because I remember I went to Ape a lot. I loved Ape, and I went every year. And now they're moving to San Jose?
Ape is in San Jose now, yeah. There were a few months ago, and my wife Emily and I drove down there to it. And still, like, a great fest, but...
San Jose.
But they ran into the same thing that we are, like, running up against, where just can't afford to be in San Francisco.
Yeah.
If you want to know, like, why the arts are leaving a city, the answer is pretty much always rent.
Yeah.
The other big thing that we did that we got a bunch of positive and negative feedback on is that for our lineup of exhibitors, we switched from a first-come, first-serve, hey, like, spots are open, come apply for them. We went to, like, an actual, like, application and review juried process. We got some folks telling us, foundedly, that we're going to be setting up, like, we're going to be becoming gatekeepers and make the fest less diverse.
Yeah.
But what we found by doing, like, a racial impact equity analysis is that when we just had it first come, first serve, the people that we got were people who already knew about us and people who were sitting in front of a computer already, which meant that it was pretty much the same white men and women every year. We weren't like completely white, but boy, we were a lot whiter than even San Francisco is, and definitely whiter than the San Francisco art scene is.
That's hard.
Yeah, that's not a hard bar to clear.
Yeah. So when we switched to an application process, we were open for 3 weeks. We actually didn't have to turn away that many people, but we had a much more diverse lineup because it wasn't dependent on like sitting in front of your computer right at that moment. And it was more time to get the word out to like other groups outside of our immediate bubble. And the attendees were a lot more diverse because people come out to see their friends. And so those people found out, in a lot of cases, like found out about zines for the first time and realized that there's like this community and this medium that they can participate in.
So can I ask what you used to jury all the applications, like what you were looking for someone to be accepted?
We prioritized, so we didn't collect any demographic information.
Okay.
But we did prioritize first timers.
Hmm. Nice.
That was the best way that we found to sort of like by proxy diversify like the group, was just to bring in new people. And those new people just de facto would be more diverse than the old people. We also asked people what percentage of your table is actually going to be zines versus, you know, like Heath Ledger as the Joker fan art.
Sure. That's a thing.
Because like there's a crossover between comics and zines, and there's a lot of people who do like great comics work within zines. But then there's a lot of like very corporate comics work that to me at least just isn't interesting and that has other places to live besides Zine Fest.
Do we have to explain what zines are to people?
Zine is short for zines.
Yes. Nailed it.
Fantastic.
Zine is classically short for magazine, sometimes like very similar to chat books. It's a self-published little like booklet that is sometimes comic, sometimes poetry, sometimes rantings, photocopied junk, how-to informational packets, whatever you want to put inside of it. And the allure of it is that it's a very low barrier to entry, creation, publication, and distribution.
So what got you into zines in the first place?
I started going to Zine Fest. No, actually, I think the first zine that I ever saw was something that my wife made before she was my wife, before we even started dating. That was a fanzine for a band that she lived with, like in this shack out in the woods that they are all squatting in together. This is in central Missouri, and there are no laws.
May I be the first to say, dude, please tell us more about that.
My wife still has like, is kind of a crust punk in some ways. Like she still has a bunch of clothes from when she was 12 that she just like still wears, or like she has some shirts that she found in a van.
We all have some van shirts.
She and her friend made this fanzine for the band. The band is called Warhammer 48K, and the fanzine was called Ham Warmer. And it was like a sort of like a Tiger Beat style, like a zine about how dreamy each of the band members are, but it was mostly photos that they had taken of the band members while they were pooping.
This is my favorite thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. And so like, I saw this and I was like, oh my God. Can I marry this person?
The answer, readers, was yes.
Well, eventually.
Eventually, yes. Yeah. Are there copies still?
I don't know. I think I might have like one of the two that they ever made someplace.
Oh my God.
One of the band members just like was terrible at posing for photographs. So they did like a photo collage of him, but just like all the same photo, just like 20 times of just like him just sawing a board. And it was like, fun facts. Loves to saw.
This is awesome. I love the ephemerality of this, that I will, in all likelihood, I will never get to see this. And any of the listeners will only ever hear of this thing that did exist.
Yeah, this is the most documentation that has ever existed of Ham Warmer happening right now into this microphone.
And it sounds amazing. And I just think it's wonderful. There's so much ubiquity. It's nice that there are things that I will never see that I still think are amazing.
Yeah, this is sort of like what attracted me to zines in the first place. The idea that it was something, I feel like because everything is documented now, sometimes whether we intend it to be or whether we don't, mm-hmm. there is something really magical about something that just exists for a moment and you either see it or you don't.
Yeah.
So like I ran a record label for a while, also in central Missouri.
Yes, I believe I heard about this. Please go on.
And we did a few releases. All of our releases had really like intentionally terrible packaging and unintentionally terrible music. But some of the ones that I'm proudest of were like, we did a CD that the packaging was that we put the CD inside of like a cloth bag and then filled it with just like grass that we'd pulled out of my front yard and then sewed it shut. And like we tried to get like some spiders or other bugs inside there as well. So they would just like fester inside your home.
Right.
And you would have to damage the packaging to open it up and actually listen to the music. We forced interaction because I just sort of like, you know, hate consumer fetishism where you just keep something in the package forever.
Right.
I wanted to like force people to interact with the thing that they had bought if they were going to like buy it in order to like be a part of whatever it was that we were doing. A good question that you might be asking is, did anyone actually like care enough to buy our stuff just to collect it?
What was the answer to that question?
Interesting question. Moving on.
I have a question.
Shoot.
Why aren't zines dead? They should be dead, right? Shouldn't they have been replaced by something a little higher tech and on the internet where everybody can see it?
It's a good question. I think that there's a couple of different answers. One is that there isn't an online platform that isn't owned by somebody else. Mm. You know, there's like Blogger, LiveJournal, you know, like PDFs in various formats that have like existed. And there are plenty of people who like make zines in physical and PDF forms. But all of that relies on a platform that somebody else controls. And the allure of zines has always been and still is that you make it yourself, you hold it yourself in your own hand, and you choose like who you hand it to.
Yeah.
And then that person like hands it on to the next person. Also, I think that zines in a real way have like really coincided with a kind of like new consumer product fetishism, that it is really thrilling to go out and like buy something and spend $3 on something that you then own and can hold in your hands.
Yeah.
That's still like wonderfully unique experience. Know that you have like a limited edition, like whatever. We've actually, one of the ongoing debates in the zine community is how useful are zines for distributing information if they're just print and they came out at a time when they were competing with big, like big run print publications, which, you know, had like barriers to entry, but now they're competing with the internet, which in theory has no barrier to entry. And that's an answer that I don't think anyone's really successfully answered just yet. And there are plenty of publications like Street Sheet actually is a really good example of a print publication that is specifically designed to reach people who do not have internet access, who are disenfranchised from media in a way that also means that they're disenfranchised from interacting online. Like, this is for them.
Yeah.
Some zines fill that void. Some zines just like look cool and are printed on wonderful paper. Some zines have like physical aspects that are very difficult to achieve with like online media. And some zines are just like fun to make.
I think that's what I liked so much about all the zines I bought like over at City Lights is it did feel very, very personal. Like
yes.
Some pages would be handwritten. It felt like I was reading a note someone had given me.
Right.
And like nothing online has that quality. If it's like, even if it's scanned in sheets, it doesn't feel personal. It just feels very sterile. I don't know.
Yeah. I think like ever since like GeoCities went down. Like, no, God, in all honesty,
I feel you. I miss it.
Are you familiar with the project 1 terabyte of kilobyte age? That's just like doing screenshots of old defunct GeoCities pages.
No, that's super interesting.
It's really fascinating. And all of, and like so many of the pages have something at like some sentence at the top being like, sorry, I haven't updated for a while.
Yeah.
But that's kind of a space where you could just make something very specific to what you wanted. And actually, I think you see that in Tumblr as well. I watch a lot of cartoons, so I see a lot of like tween Tumblrs, and they're all like, they put a shitload of work into those to make them look exactly like they want.
But I also think like with GeoCities, you were building a page and you were talking directly to people, whereas like Twitter, Facebook, even Tumblr, you're kind of just broadcasting something to anyone who will hear it. I think that's kind of the difference. And I don't know. When I post something on Twitter, it's not personal. It's not directed to anyone. It's just sort of like spilled hummus all over myself.
I did see that you tweeted that recently.
Yesterday I spilled hummus all over myself.
She did. She did.
I wanted you to say that she actually didn't, that she just made that up to be interesting on Twitter.
No,
and that was just the most interesting thing she could think of.
I think I tweeted it before I cleaned up the hummus.
Oh, yeah.
I think that might be true.
Anyways, what I was getting at is like, GeoCities felt more personal because you weren't just putting it out there for anyone and everyone to see.
Right.
It was more like the link you sent to your friends and things like that. So that message of like, sorry, I haven't posted in a while. It's really like, I was communicating with you.
Yes.
So,
with like the five people that you know have said that they were like, go look at your GeoCities page.
And GeoCities was so much not a platform in the way that Tumblr is that you could languish in obscurity all you wanted. You could get absolutely zero hits. Which in this day, like you can do, but it's more difficult because you are findable by default. But GeoCities, I made when I was 10 or 11, I was making GeoCities fan sites.
Do you think that's also like a change in culture is now we look people up? Like whenever you meet someone new, you like Google for them and you like try to add them on your different social network platforms. And
I
that
Googled
wasn't the
shit out of you.
Yeah, we were Googling you. But like
gross.
You wouldn't do that back in the day, right? Like. When GeoCities were big, I would never Google someone. Well, Google wasn't around.
Yeah, Google wasn't around. You would hotbot someone.
Yeah, I went hotbot or...
Lycos.
Lycos, yeah, that was the one.
Dogpile. Alta Vista.
Oh, Alta Vista. Babelfish still around?
I think, no.
Google Translate ate it?
Yeah, I think Google Translate ate it.
That's too bad.
Can we just talk about old search engines for like the next like 25 minutes? and then close?
This isn't Daring Fireball.
Okay, wait. So I had a question. How many people out there have your name?
Oh, so this is talking about the piece that I wrote for Tomorrow Magazine, That's So Channing.
Yep.
Which is used to be my Twitter handle and then changed at some point. There are maybe either two or three people who aren't me who are named Channing Kennedy.
Well, okay.
Let's give a little background for why you asked that.
Oh, because I had heard about That's So Channing and that you were interviewing people with your name. And I was like,
but the people listening haven't heard of it.
Yeah, that's why I'm telling them right now. Yeah, so I just heard that you were interviewing people with your name and was like, that's not a particularly common name. I wonder how many people he interviewed.
The answer is zero because neither Channing Kennedy wanted anything to do with me. Oh. Basically, I was trying to write a piece about how much do you own your own name in this present time when your name is also like your keywords and your branding and like your reputation online. I started thinking about it. I realized that the other two people named Channing Kennedy, both of whom are younger than me, one of them is a white woman, one of them is a black man. I think one of them is like a liberal blogger involved in politics for a while, and one of them is like a high school athlete, at least based on his like Google hits. But both of them are buried under like three pages of like me and my underpants wearing cat ears. So when someone searches for them, they just find like
some white guy.
Some white guy.
Oh, wow.
Oh, and also some white guy with like a really bad sense of boundaries and the idea that maybe things actually don't get deleted off the internet.
So some white guy?
Yeah.
Oh boy.
And so I want to talk to the two of them about like, have you formed opinions about me based on the inevitability that you probably Googled yourself at some point and found me? Neither of them like got back to me or like wanted to talk to me, which is completely understandable to be clear. I interviewed a couple other people. I interviewed a woman who had the same name as Lindsay Lohan's character in The Parent Trap and who was the same age as that character when that movie came out.
Oh, no.
And who just like her, you know, grade school life was just like flipped, turned upside down when that happened. And I found, so my actual first name is Ian.
Oh.
And I found someone named Ian Kennedy who, actually, I don't think this interview even got into the piece, but he told me this incredible story about seeing his own Google search results gradually get replaced by Ian Kennedy, the pitcher for the Arizona Diamondbacks.
Oh, wow. And he like watched it happen?
And he watched it happen because he's like also in tech. And he's Japanese-American. His parents named him Ian because it's a name that can be expressed in like Japanese characters or in English. We had this really interesting conversation. And then like, as is the way with like writing, like none of it like ever saw the light of day. Here's the other story about that piece is that I have a bunch of mental health issues. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, like I think like a year or two before that piece, I wrote a piece about Oakland rap and like DIY music videos. And then after the piece came out, I just decided that I absolutely hated it. And every time I saw something that reminded me of like Oakland, like the hip hop scene, I would just like compulsively like whisper out loud, like, you fucking idiot. Like I'd just be driving in the car and I'd see a billboard and it's like, you fucking piece of shit. And I think that happened a couple other times where I wrote something and then anytime I saw anything that reminded me of that piece that I just like dumped months of my life into for like for nothing, I would just compulsively be like, you piece of shit, fuck you. And then I wrote a piece about my own name.
Oh no.
I went into a cafe and ordered like a latte or whatever. And they said, okay, great, what's your name? And I said, it's Channing, you fucking piece of shit.
Oh boy.
Oh no. You have to leave a big tip when you do that.
I did. And I thought, oh my God, I hope this person doesn't think I'm crazy. And then I thought, I'm probably actually crazy. And also that's much better than them thinking that I just called them a piece of shit.
I'm closest to the door.
I'm riding this out.
Yeah.
So you've said your name several times and you haven't called yourself a piece of shit until just now.
What am I calling myself a piece of shit about these days?
So is it a one at a time thing?
Nah, I can fit like a few into the queue at once.
Okay.
But like all that stuff is like far enough in the past at this point that like, you know, it's like I've healed over.
Yeah.
But now it'll be stuff like, like an email that I sent or something like that. And I'll see something that reminds me of it and just like, just bam. Or actually, I had to cancel my gym membership because I couldn't go to the gym without just like having a fucking breakdown.
I think we all feel that.
Yeah.
Different reasons usually.
Different, yeah.
But the outcome is the same.
Sure.
Which is that, well, at least for me, I'll be dead of a heart attack when I'm 37.
But you will have truly lived.
I have truly lived by not wasting any of my time in a gym.
Yes.
Yeah.
Fuck you, gym industrial complex.
That's probably the first time anyone said those exact words.
Here's a little tip that I can pass on to your listeners. Just stick industrial complex at the end of any phrase and you'll sound like Malcolm Gladwell.
Wow.
That's pretty accurate.
I like how the two of you laughed and then you both like thought about it at the same time.
You're like, oh, that's not a joke. That's for real.
This has been a very real episode.
Okay, so I have a question. What is low art?
Low art is versus high art. Low art is comic strips. Low art is jokes. Low art is anything that is created with an intent to influence the way people think and feel, but that does not hang in a gallery.
Hmm. Can I get super inside baseball for a second?
Yes.
Would you consider an artist who attempted to make... Okay, so for instance, Keith Haring did all kinds of subway art. Like
yes.
he would do installations inside of subways where he just like climb onto the tracks and draw over ads. Mm-hmm. That's clearly low art. But when they take that down and put that into the MoMA, which they did in town,
right?
Is it then high art or does it stay low art?
I mean, this is a debate that like the arts community has been having ever since like pre-Dadaism. Mm-hmm. Keith Haring is an interesting example though, because he came out of, like a lot of his work is like heavily influenced by the AIDS crisis, which incidentally is where like a lot of like early zines came out of as well.
Right.
And chapbooks. I don't think there's a good answer because I don't think it's like really important to answer the question of whether that's high art or low art. I think a better answer is who's making money off of it once it ends up in a gallery. Mm-hmm. And is it any of the people that Keith Haring would have wanted like to benefit from his work? The reason that he was painting on subways in the first place is because he knew that the people that he wanted to reach weren't going to be in a gallery anytime soon. I think any artist who like really wants to like reach people is probably going to do some work that isn't within like the studio, gallery, academia network. I just retweeted this thing about, I guess Keith Haring was using like a tile system for some of his designs.
Oh, I saw that.
Which I really want to do some more research on. I have a lot of friends who are like indie game designers who also come from like very disenfranchised parts of community. But to me, like that was so interesting to see that he was just taking like the exact same approach as the way that like Shigeru Miyamoto was designing Mario. Like same paper, same grid system, like probably like same number two pencil in the same year.
Wow. That's neat. That tickled my brain. I never thought about that. What?
That's funny. Your brain being tickled.
Happens sometimes. It's an ongoing issue.
That's funny. Not any of the jokes that you made. The thing that you said in seriousness.
Yeah. Okay. Steph, do you have any more Post-it notes?
No. See, I write down questions on Post-its so that we feel like we have structure to this program. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything coming up that people should know about?
The big thing is San Francisco Zine Fest, Labor Day weekend. We will open applications for exhibitors June 1st through June 21st. I don't think if I have anything exciting coming up, I'm going to be on this podcast that we're recording right now.
Cool.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
I think your verb tenses are right for that.
Other than that, I mean, like my main activity right now, honestly, is just being a house husband because fortunately my wife got a full-time job with benefits at the Berkeley Public Library, which if you know any librarians, you know that like when you get a full-time job, you basically just like sit on top of a throne of skulls forever of all the people that you defeated to get that job.
Awesome.
So I'm trying to make her life as easy as possible right now because I'm like pulling in some money, but not like as much money as I would like to be pulling in. And the barista job that I work at sometime hasn't like called me in for a shift in a while. I don't know. One thing I appreciate about this podcast is that one of your previous guests, I forget who, like talked about being a barback.
Oh, yeah,
Hampton.
Yeah. Like that honestly was like really reassuring for me. Like, oh yeah, everyone has like multiple hustles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are in the service industry because that's the only guaranteed source of income for basically anyone.
Totally.
Yeah. Everyone's going to need coffee and booze.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hampton barbacks there and then gets off his shift and then just sits down. That's just, he's at that, but he's going to be at that bar anyway. And so he figured he'd just start working.
Makes sense.
Yeah. It's a good hustle.
Mm-hmm.
And I've enjoyed talking to you about your many hustles.
Thank you, Liam.
We wish you well.
Do you want to hold hands across the table?
A little.
Okay.
Just a little. Just for a second.
Aww. Nice.
Okay.
The shirt I'm wearing is by Liz Ryerson.
Yes.
Ella Guro on, Print All Over Me. I'm wearing this to promote her work.
It is a nice, spectacular shirt, and I enjoy it a lot.
It's, you know, this is the bad idea to wear it in this medium, but you get the idea.
I would describe it as pixely, glitchy, and effervescent.
Hmm.
It was the first thing we noticed when you walked in. It was like, cool shirt. Oh, hey, Channing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great shirt for radio.
I think that's our closing punchline.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you.